This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. Hour number three as we get rolling along. Alan Popar is going to join us later this hour. We're going to talk about the Miami Dolphins, who are off to a 2-0 start. So the Dolphins are under new head coach Mike McDaniel, and you can see in some of the videos, and we'll talk to Alan about this, how excited the players are with their new coach. Brian Flores was a fine coach, but he wasn't a player's coach. There's no doubt about it. He was a disciplinarian guy. But that doesn't mean you can't win with a disciplinarian guy. It just means players have certain attitudes towards guys like that. Some people embrace that. Some people don't have any time in the world for it. But Mike McDaniel seems to be the exact opposite. They seem enthusiastic. They genuinely like him. They dump Gatorade on him when he came in after a win, like little bottles of Gatorade, which was awesome. Like, they're really embracing the culture that he's providing. And Tua Tagovailoa needs that to thrive. It's very difficult to thrive and be known to secure your job when you're dealing with a disciplinarian head coach. Now, you should be able to, right? The question is, well, if you can't do it with a disciplinarian coach, don't really trust you with a very player-friendly coach. But nevertheless, you can start seeing Tua willing to go down the road with Mike McDaniel on certain things. These deep plays to try to get back into the game, being a lot more aggressive, taking chances. Brian Daboll is doing the exact same thing. Here's the thing that I like about those two guys. They appear ready to be head coaches. They appeared like guys that were willing and able to take over a team and know what to do in order to do it. Right, they didn't come in going, you know, I was just a lowly offensive coordinator or defensive coordinator, and I have no idea what I'm doing. Those two individuals that ran offenses for their the previous teams seem to have been ready for the challenge of being a head coach and all of the things of being a head coach, making sure you have the right staff, making sure you know your personnel, make sure you know what you can do and what you can't do, what you don't have the ability to do. Those are the things that are quite really important. Now, some young coaches don't know that right away. They have a feeling like they have a program, they're going to stick to the program, even if in the end they can't quite get the results that they're looking for. In the end, it's the program and the idea, the philosophy that matters. That's what plagued Josh McDaniels in Denver. He didn't have the quarterback he wanted, but he acted as if he did. And in the end, Kyle Orton wasn't the guy that could pull out a long-term successful season. Started off strong, ended up 8-8. But I think these two guys have a good handle on what they have. Brian Jones may not be the quarterback, but Saquon Barkley is the running back.
This is Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, again, TV themes on a Throwback Thursday. This is West Wing. I remember this show.
Yep.
You know how I remember, why I remember this show? Because the President of the United States, Josiah Bartlett, Jeb Bartlett, whatever his name was, he was from New Hampshire.
Ah.
That's right.
So you voted for him.
He was a New Hampshire guy. Yeah, that's right. And I remember he had a line in there that I laughed, and I had to explain to my wife why it was a big deal. He was having a pancake breakfast, and he was angry. They put Vermont maple syrup on the thing. And I laughed, and my wife asked me, I said, because we would never eat that. That might as well be
tar.
Oil. Right, exactly. Vermont maple syrup. I have to ship in New Hampshire maple syrup to my house. I have to get my friends to send it to me. I won't, because it's like, you know, obviously.
You never hear about New Hampshire maple syrup.
It's great. It's great. It's the best. I used to eat maple syrup candy. It was awesome. There were maple syrup places everywhere.
So how did Vermont get the status of being the maple syrup state of the.
Don't know. But,
the U.S. of A.
Yeah. But, yeah. I was in like a Trader Joe's. And they had Vermont maple syrup, and I took a picture of it and sent it to my friend. I'm like, I can't find the good stuff. Seriously. I mean, Vermont maple syrup is like ketchup. I mean, it might as well just be ketchup or mustard. If that's what you like on your pancakes, put Vermont maple syrup on it. That's fine.
I just prefer like they're not Aunt Jemima anymore
right.
Mrs. Whatever Butterworth, that is. Whatever. Yeah, exactly. Log Cabin.
Now, I will say
store
this.
Brand.
This is probably blasphemy, but I will say this. Canadian maple syrup, that's really good. That's the best.
Well, now you're just being un-American.
I know.
It was all right that you couldn't, you wanted to go to civil war with Vermont.
Vermont, of all places.
Come on. But now you're just, you're choosing Canada over the U.S.? Come on,
that's
Tony.
Like, that's one of those things where it's like local pride that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, if I took Vermont maple syrup and New Hampshire maple syrup and poured it on pancakes, you wouldn't tell the difference.
I know exactly what you're talking about because I tell everyone here in Houston constantly, especially if they grew up here, constantly, I'm like, there's no good Mexican food in Houston.
Right. Yeah,
I will let everyone know, and I will die on this hill right now.
And
everyone's like, well, you're just not going to the right spots. I'm like, no, you guys don't know what Mexican food is.
That's right.
I lived in Southern California. They make good Mexican food there.
Yeah. That's one of those things, man. I'm telling you. It's like,
I know I'm right, so it's okay.
Yeah.
Just like you know you're right about New Hampshire maple syrup.
I know I'm right. I don't think I'm right.
Yeah,
I know it. I'm right. Right? So, anyway, West Wing.
Someone like me coming to it, I wouldn't even know the difference, probably.
Did West Wing, this is a question before we get back to our topic of what's going on tonight. West Wing, do you think people saw that, wanted to get into politics, and then went into politics and went, wait a minute, this is not what I thought it was going to be?
You mean how they could impact something in an hour?
Yeah. Like they went, oh, wait a minute.
They were able to affect change.
Rob Lowe looked like he was having a lot more fun with this job than I actually have.
Yeah.
No, where's the... Plus, you have to understand, anything that's written by Aaron Sorkin is speechy. That's what he does. That's his style. When he does screenplays, movies, TV shows, what Aaron Sorkin writes is very poetic. Everybody's making a speech instead of having conversations, right? Everything is in flowery language. That's how he writes. So when kids were like, I'm going to Washington. I'm going to work in politics. And then they get there and it's like, oh shoot, this isn't even close to what I thought it was going to be. Still a very good show though. Still, I thought it was a very good show. It got a little preachy, but it was still a good show.
It did.
Yeah. It had a lot of good storylines, whatever. John Goodman was on that show. He was up. He played the president in a crisis when the daughter got kidnapped. He had to step in and be president. So, all right. Nevertheless, tonight, Steelers and the Browns. It's going to kick off Week 3 tomorrow. Don't forget, we go over all the games and tell you what we like and we don't like. But I want to get back to what I was talking about earlier, which was Mike McDaniel. We're going to talk to Alan Popar about this and Brian Daboll. These are guys that are just 2-0 on the season. Matt Eberflus as well. But the Ringer had a really good article today about Nathaniel Hackett. And as I was reading it, it sort of reminded me of a couple things. First of all, let me say this. I don't want to bury Nathaniel Hackett as a head coach after just 2 games. But I do know this, that being a head coach in the National Football League, while it is an on-the-job, you do a lot of on-the-job learning when you first get into the league, you shouldn't be absolutely completely naive as to what you should be able to do, right? It's like any job. When you go into any job, you're going to learn as you go. If you're a first-time manager at a bank, you might make a mistake or something. But not knowing anything about banking makes you go, oh my God, that's not a good hire. He can't be president of the bank if he doesn't really know how to do basic things about running a bank. Same thing here. Nathaniel Hackett, Aaron Rodgers was all about Nathaniel Hackett at Green Bay, right? So why did the Broncos hire him? Because they wanted Aaron Rodgers. They wanted Aaron Rodgers. It didn't really matter if Nathaniel Hackett didn't have sort of some of the great attributes that you're looking for in a head coach. And remember, the one thing that surprised me with the Broncos hire was after Gary Kubiak left, they went with Vance Joseph, and then they went with Vic Fangio, and then they went with another guy who had never been a head coach before. I thought that the last two hires were hires that were okay. They had gone through John Fox, who had been a head coach with Carolina. They had gone through Gary Kubiak, who had been the head coach at Houston, and then came back to Denver, where he was very successful part of the organization in a lot of different ways. But the reality was they wanted fresh look at the team. They wanted a fresh view of the team. They wanted one of the young up-and-coming guys. So they went and got Vance Joseph, and then they went and got Vic Fangio, who had been in the league 30-plus years. It was 32 to be exact when he got hired. and never got a chance to be a head coach, and they gave him a chance to be head coach. This was a team that won a Super Bowl on defense. They went with one of the best defensive guys, a guy so respected in the league for his longevity at running defenses. They went with him, but he had never been a head coach before. And he had a lot of these shortcomings that come with being a head coach that you don't, you know, you could be in a comfort zone as a coordinator, but being a head coach and running a staff, a big staff, is something that a lot of people can't do effectively. And Vic Fangio, for all the wonderful things that he was as a defensive mind, he wasn't very good at all of the other things that you need to be a head coach. Nathaniel Hackett hasn't shown anybody whether he has those things yet. Why was he hired? He was hired because the Broncos wanted Aaron Rodgers as their quarterback. But in the last minute, Rodgers decided to stay in Green Bay. He didn't follow his offensive coordinator to Denver. And as I've said many times, I wouldn't have either. If I'm Aaron Rodgers, I want to get to the Super Bowl again, and the best way to do it is in the NFC North, because half the battle to make the Super Bowl is to make the playoffs. And you can be great, and you can be an Aaron Rodgers-level player in the AFC and barely make the playoffs, because that division and that conference is going to be really tough. So why don't you go through your division, win it with ease, get to the postseason, and let the chips fall where they may. Rodgers stayed with the Packers, despite all the problems. And I said many times about Aaron Rodgers and the Packers, I never thought he wanted to leave. I thought he wanted a better Green Bay Packers. I thought he toyed with them enough to get them to do exactly what he wanted, but he never wanted to go anywhere. Going somewhere, is, especially at his age, it's a risk. Your legacy is in play. Nope. Stay within the organization. Make the organization better. That being said, what Hackett hasn't learned yet is how to manage his team properly. He filled it with young people that are all sort of excited to be part of this, but in the end, they aren't executing the proper things that you need. They haven't scored within the red zone. Their only touchdowns this year have come outside the 20-yard line. They're 0 for 5 in touchdowns in red zone situations, settling for field goals. Right? They can't score a touchdown inside the red zone. They've mismanaged the clock. They've mismanaged down and distance. They haven't figured out the best way to get their personnel on the field. They had to take a timeout against the Texans to make sure a punt returner was on the field. They are miscommunicating like crazy. Now, again, if you're the Broncos and you bought this team, and this is the guy that came with what you bought, it's not your guy. He came with what you bought. How long do you go, hey, I'm sorry, but can you get your act together? Because I don't mind if you go for it on 4th and 3 to try to extend a drive, then kick a long field goal, but you stand by that decision. Then you come to my office and you say, I would have done it 100 times. That play should have worked. I will go for it again. I would rather go for it than risk a long field goal. I would rather, as an owner, you do that then you come to me and say, in the heat of the moment, I had no idea what to do. When everyone was looking to me to make a decision, I couldn't make a decision fast enough. Because, again, being a head coach in the NFL is learning a bit. Being a new head coach is learning a bit. But there are things you have to have in the toolbox. And one of the things you have to have is clock, down and distance, personnel, execution of what we're going to be doing in certain situations. Those things should be absolutely automatic. And for this Bronco teams, they're not automatic. And I would be really nervous if I owned this team, because I've got a commitment. The previous administration gave this guy a commitment that I have to honor. I bought this team. I have to honor the contracts that came with it. But if this guy doesn't have this in his toolbox, what are the other things that he's missing that we haven't seen because we haven't played that many games yet? How does he handle real discipline? How is he going to handle other things that will pop up as the weeks go on? How is he going to handle key injuries? If this guy can't get a punt return around on the field in a punting situation, how is he going to handle replacing or finding ways to replace a Cortland Sutton, for example, if he goes down with injury, or Jerry Jeudy, who has a shoulder injury right now? If I was the ownership of the Broncos, that would make me nervous. So again, look at Brian Daboll, look at Mike McDaniel, first-year head coaches, young guys. that had success with organizations that made it to the playoffs and made good runs in the playoffs. The 49ers and the Buffalo Bills. They're off to 2-0 starts. I got no idea if the Dolphins make the postseason or the Giants make the postseason. I don't care at this point. It's not my concern. My concern in week three is that whatever they're selling, their players are buying. In the end, it's going to be the players that are going to execute on the field and do the job of what the coach wants. But in Bronco land, imagine being a six-year veteran and your head coach can't decide whether to kick a field goal or go for it on fourth down so the play clock runs out because he didn't call timeout and he totally forgot that the play clock existed. Or a valuable timeout was used to get a punt returner on the field. Or the opposition, the offense is having to scream at you, pass or run, because they think you don't know. If you're a veteran on the Broncos, you might be looking at that team going, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for a guy who's learning how to communicate with his coordinators. That should have been sorted out long ago. That's the difference. And if I was the Denver Broncos, I'd be really nervous about this. Now, Nathaniel Hackett could grow into being one of the more successful coaches in this league. But the reality of it is right now he's not showing the same thing that Brian Daboll and Mike McDaniel are showing after 2 weeks, which is an embracement by the team to everything that they're in for. And again, Alan Papar is going to shed some light on that as we got in about 15 minutes as we talk to him about the Dolphins, who are 2-0, that will be hosting the Buffalo Bills coming up this weekend. It's not a must-win game by any means, but can you imagine if the Dolphins won that game, what it would mean to what they're building to beat the Bills? All right, on Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver, that's Ron with two N's. We continue with Wake Up Call.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, Alan Papar is going to join us in about 10 minutes, but this is the theme to Lost, and we actually played it again because I said when we played it earlier in the show today that I didn't have enough time to actually talk about this show. We're doing Throwback Thursday today. We're playing TV themes of shows that debuted on this date, September 22nd, at various years. I was addicted to this show, and then I was angry at this show. I think that was the feeling for a lot of people.
I think that's the best way to describe the show.
I was so mad at it. I was in, and so I watched it, and I watched it religiously when it was on, and I commented on it with other people, but you could sense that it was like, this is going absolutely nowhere.
That first season was beyond fantastic.
Oh, it was incredible.
I mean, we didn't know what we were watching.
We didn't know that they didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
Like, we thought, oh, how are they going to put this all together? This is so nuts. This is so wild. And little did we know that they were like, oh, my God. Where are we going with this? Where are we doing? What are we doing? We got a polar bear on this thing. What are we doing?
The black mist.
Now, wasn't there the guy that had to reset something every 90 minutes? Remember that? He was in like that little cubby thing?
Yeah.
Like what?
In that bunker?
He wouldn't be alive. Wouldn't his body just shut down like you're not getting enough sleep? There's no REM sleep.
Yeah.
Like you can't just take 1 hour naps forever and survive, can you?
Couldn't find a professor somewhere on the island to to set a timer.
Yeah.
So it just does it automatically.
So
no, I mean, I was into that show too for like the first couple of seasons, like season two, season three. And I was like, all right, I'm still with this because there's still a lot of mystery. And then you got that sense. You know what it was? It was kind of like watching Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Game of Thrones ran out of book material and then it went absolutely ridiculous.
And that's exactly what happened to them. They built all these different storylines, all these webs going off in different directions. And they were like, okay, well, now we're having trouble bringing it all the way back to center again.
It was one of the shows, my brother and I were hanging out one day, and he came down to visit, and he said, do you watch Lost? And I said, no. And he goes, what? And he was like surprised. And I said, no, I don't. And he was like, dude, it's great. You need to watch it. And then I got, back then, Netflix was like, you got the DVDs. So I signed up and I got like the first season, like I got three DVDs and I would send them back and so this was probably 2008, 2009, whatever that was. And I could not I couldn't sleep. Like, I watched them all the time. Like, I would stay up late watching another episode, and I was so into it. And so then I caught up with where I was supposed to be with the season, and then my wife got into it, and she was into it, and we would. And next thing I know, I'm having these conversations at work about it. But I was like, and then towards the end, it didn't quite. It was so bad, it just didn't end properly. But it did show you when everybody was kind of going to other avenues, right? When everybody was going in, like, going to these shows like Sopranos on HBO and things like that, where television was getting better, that network TV could still do something halfway decent and have people kind of locked in on it. So, but it just didn't work for me at the end. I didn't get it. I were they in purgatory? I have no idea. Well, they were all at the church. I didn't quite get it. I didn't like.
And that was the thing, right? We weren't alone.
Yeah.
In feeling that way, because we had no idea, like, where did the storyline go? What happened? I mean, you were building up this brilliant thing that captivated us. That, I mean, it was appointment watching TV. If you didn't watch it, because we didn't really have DVRs then. I mean, you had TiVo, but, that was iffy. But you had to watch it so you can talk about it the next day.
It was a lot of television critics ended up getting serious, like, promotion, because they would be writing for, they'd be a TV critic for whatever, and they would be writing these essays, these long articles about Lost and the meaning and all these things, and people were gobbling them up. And next thing you know, like, they were getting millions of hits on their, because people were Googling Lost meaning, and then these critics, their articles would pop up, and some of them made, ended up getting advancements and moving on to other bigger publications because they wrote really good columns about the last episode of Lost, of all things. And they're like, some of them said, I got a couple thousand hits on these TV reviews at my local paper. And then next thing you know, Lost came on and I'm doing these articles. And next thing you know, they just spiked because everybody around the country was reading so much into the meaning of the TV show. That can be a good thing. It can be a bad thing. If you're a TV writer, it can be a great thing when there's a mystery and you're people trying to figure out your mystery, but you better have an answer to the mystery. And I think that was the lesson. Like, you better have a there, and they didn't have a there. They were making it up as they went along and it didn't make sense. And so that's the trouble. Like, and you know what the other thing too is? When television comes around, they go, that's a great pilot. Now I need 26 of these. And you go, oh, okay. Like, yeah, that's how it works.
And that's always a problem. Movie. Like, the pilots for a lot of shows are phenomenal.
They're
supposed to be. And then it's like, a lot of times they don't even know what to do in the second episode.
Because the executives look at it and they go, brilliant. I love it. I'll do a 20 episode run. And then you go, great. We don't know what we're going to do.
We just had the story for this idea.
We had this idea. And then the other thing too is if it's successful, and you're doing a show. This brought on a lot of TV shows had like these mysteries.
Yep.
And how many of them got canceled before the mystery got solved? Because they were like, that's it. It didn't work. You had 5 million viewers on week one, and then it was down to 900,000 by week three. You're out.
I think one of the most famous ones in recent memory for me was Jericho.
Oh, Jericho. Yeah, I remember that. The nuclear bomb went off.
A bunch of nuclear bombs went off all over the place. And there was a small town in Kansas, I think, or somewhere in Colorado, or, somewhere like that, where you could see the nuclear bomb going off. I think they were in Kansas because they saw it in Denver or something like that. And the show, there was a mystery because you wanted to know what happened. How did we get to the stage? And then it got canceled. But then people, they didn't know that there was a lot of fans. And I guess one of the taglines was, or one of the themes of the show was nuts, because they were talking about a grandfather fighting in World War II, and he was just like, oh, nuts, let's go, go battle or something like that. So they just started sending nuts to the producers of the show, or to the studio heads.
So did they make it again?
And they made another season, but everyone was like, oh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you kind of ruined it. Never mind.
Right.
And then it was canceled, finally.
I like it when we do television themes for Throwback Thursday. It opens up in a little dialogue. We'll talk Dolphins next. 2-0, and an exciting 2-0 at that. What's their secret? We'll find out next. It's Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.
This is Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, we're still working on Alan Popar of the Sports Illustrated to talk about the Miami Dolphins as we continue along with a Wake Up Call on a Throwback Thursday. Oh, you got to hit me up on this
Family Matters.
Family Matters. Okay, very good. This was part of TGI Friday, right?
Yes, sir.
On ABC. Yeah, there you go. All these debuting on this date. What a day to have all these shows that made their debut on the 22nd of April. September, I'm sorry. But the Miami Dolphins are off to a 2-0 start. And look, Tua Tagovailoa is going to be a really fun quarterback to watch this season because he really is starting to grow and develop as a legitimate NFL weapon. I mean, in terms of being a quarterback, he's not just a guy that can play quarterback in the NFL. He's developing into a guy that can play the position in the NFL really well. He's starting to throw the ball downfield. At the very beginning, the criticism was that he was accurate on short passes but didn't go deep. Now he's going deep. They're 2-0. Mike McDaniel is running the show, and Alan Popar covers him for Sports Illustrated and joins us on a Progressive Guest Line. How are you, my friend?
Doing great. How about yourself?
Good. All right, let's start with Mike McDaniel. Now we're two games in. We kind of had a feeling of what kind of coach he was going to be in this offseason when we had you back on in August for the preview of the Dolphins. We talked about his player-coach ideal, but how have you seen the way the players react to him and how he reacts to them over 2 weeks?
Well, considering they're 2-0, we kind of expected everything, you know, be hunky-dory. The thing that's been impressive is that, obviously, the resilience that they showed in the game at Baltimore on Sunday was pretty impressive. More so than player-coach relationships, which I think we kind of knew was going to be good based on what we saw in the offseason. More so than that, what's absolutely blown me away are the play designs and the play calling that we've seen in the first 2 weeks. I mean, the thing against Baltimore was absolutely beautiful.
In terms of being that kind of, was that missing? Is that the kind of coach and is that the kind of scheme that Tua was looking for or Tua needed to sort of unlock what he's doing right now?
Well, it's a combination of things. I mean, even last year, you could have called all the creative plays you wanted, Tyreek Hill to on the opposite side of Jalen Waddle, wide receiver. So adding him creates all sorts of opportunities. And then Mike McDaniel's play design gets guys in space. And you hear announcers say all the time, like, well, they want to get guys in space. Well, no duh. Obviously, you want to get guys in space. But McDaniel is finding ways to do that with his schemes. And you notice a lot of passes at the line of scrimmage or behind the line of scrimmage. And when a guy catches the ball, he's got open space in front of him. And the yak is just off the charts. The Dolphins had like 218 yards after the catch against Baltimore on Sunday, which is an absolutely mind-boggling number.
But I want to get to the kind of the what people were thinking, and this is people outside of Miami, of course, or maybe even people in Miami, that the thought process with Tua was, let's bring Tyreek Hill in because he's accurate on short throws, and then he'll throw it to him short, and then Tyreek Hill will do the rest. I know it's easier to throw a bomb when you have Tyreek Hill and you get separation, but it almost was, well, he can't throw a bomb even if you have Tyreek Hill. That's not what he does well.
Yeah, no, I'm not buying that. And in fact, there was one play in his rookie season in 2020 that should have ended that notion immediately, and for some reason it didn't, and it stuck around. And it was against Cincinnati late in the year. He threw a perfect pass to Jakeem Grant, about 55 yards downfield, hit him in stride, and Grant dropped the ball, otherwise it would have been a 90-yard touchdown. So this notion that Tua couldn't throw a deep pass was ridiculous. If the guy's open, he's going to hit him. The thing with Tua, and I don't know how many times I've said this, is when it comes to the arm strength, the issue is not completing a deep pass, because if you've got protection, the guy's open, he's going to hit him. The issue is if he has to throw off his back foot, if he has to zip it. Like, for example, this first interception against Baltimore last Sunday, if you remember, it was a deep end to Tyreek Hill. Hill slipped a little bit coming out of his break, and the ball took a while to get there, and that allowed the safety Marcus Williams to jump into the play, tip it up in the air, and catch it. That's where the Tua arm strength issue comes into play. The deep ball, no, it wasn't. The idea of adding Tyreek Hill was you're going to get a lot of yak, but I don't think they ever necessarily dismissed the notion that, you could hit some deep balls with him.
Let's talk about that Ravens game. How did it start? What was the spark that led to what they did in that fourth quarter of that game?
Oh, That's a good question. Because there was, I mean, it was nonstop. You know, it was nonstop key play after key play. I'd almost go back to the last play of the third quarter, which came right after Lamar Jackson's 79-yard touchdown run made it 35-14. And if you recall, that was a 33-yard completion to Jaylen Waddle, which immediately put the Dolphins into Baltimore territory to start the fourth quarter. So that set the tone. Then, if you want to look at when he played, where, like, okay, they got this thing, and you had the fourth down stuff on Lamar Jackson when it was 35-14. On fourth and one from the Miami, I think it was 41, because if Jackson gets the first down, or if Baltimore gets the first down with a better play call, then you're looking at them bleeding two more minutes off the clock and adding a field goal because Justin Tucker doesn't miss. So now it would have been 38-14 with 7 minutes left. And now we're talking a whole different situation.
So, again, 2-0 is 2-0, and it's still very early in the season. But what about that particular win and where they are right now? What has this week been like with the team and getting ready for Buffalo? There's so many emotions that you have to sort of keep in check for the long haul, but at the same time, four touchdowns in the fourth quarter and a comeback win like that, there's got to be a little bit of carryover, right?
No. And the thing is, and this is very typical of NFL players in 2022, like even if deep down, I mean, they're completely just about what they were able to accomplish on Sunday, by Monday, Tuesday at the latest, that's gone. Now the focus is Buffalo. And while it's a huge game in terms of A, establishing the Dolphins, stamping the Dolphins as legitimate, I mean, forget AFC's contenders. They beat the Bills on Sunday, and you have to start talking about them as legitimate AFC contenders. Not only that, and it stamps them as, again, as equals to Buffalo, a team that's beaten them seven straight times. And despite the magnitude of that game, all you're going to get from players this week are, it's just another game, it's 1-17 and all that. They don't want to blow it up
But Alan, I've been in these locker rooms too, and yet at the same time, it's not what they say afterwards. When they're done, they don't pretend like it's 1-17. That seems like a cliched thing players say to say it, but
correct.
I got to think that there's a different mentality at 2-0 than 1-1 getting blown out if you don't complete that comeback.
No question. I mean, I'm not debating that with you. I mean, they're obviously, you want to talk about a confidence boost. I mean, that's what they got.
That's what I was leaning towards. I mean, does it feel like now they know, hey, listen, that win, we know more about us now than we did had we lost 35-14.
Well, clearly, and it just reinforced everything that they've done and everything that Mike McDaniel has told them. That, I mean, he's got like three things or three rules. There's one is protect the team, and another one is adversity. Oh, I don't remember exactly what it is, but basically along the lines of adversity is opportunity. Well, they have adversity against Baltimore, and they had the opportunity about it, and they did. So it only reinforced what McDaniel's been saying, and if they hadn't totally bought in before, they certainly now. But
right.
All I was saying is that that could be the vibe that they're giving, that you're never going to hear anything about it like that, because that's not what players do.
The only reason I bring that up is because I've heard many, many times players say, this doesn't matter, this doesn't matter. And then when something does happen, they say things like, nobody believed in us. And then I go, well, what the hell did you care what we felt before? If you're telling us it didn't matter, now you're saying it mattered because now you tell, like, I'm thinking if you throw six touchdown passes, there's a feeling about this quarterback now that is got to be somewhat different than they felt if he didn't do this.
Here's the thing though, is they've been publicly praising Tua since the start of the off season. And that was like, it seemed like an orchestrated campaign to do everything we can to help this guy out in his third NFL season so he takes a big step forward that we want him to see, that we want to see. So if all they're saying after the success on game is, well, we knew all along he had it in him, and even Mike McDaniel said yesterday nobody was surprised. Well, sorry, but I don't think anybody expected him to throw six touchdown passes. And the other thing, too, is about publicly making it a big deal, the Buffalo game coming up, is if they lose, when the last thing they want is to build it up so much,
right,
like what it could mean to them if they win, and if they lose, it's like, well, what now?
Yeah, because you're right. That's a great point, because this is still, like, it's not a week three matchup. It may feel, you know, like, hey, this is now 2-0, but it's still not, it doesn't define anything yet.
No, and this is one of those games where I would tell you the consequences of a win are incredibly greater for the Dolphins than if they lose. Like, right. If they lose, they're supposed to lose. Buffalo's better. And then you still got plenty of time to get your season on track and then make the playoffs. If they win, whoa. So, yeah, this is one of those, I mean, it's a great opportunity in terms of the benefits and downfall, if, depending on the outcome.
I just think from the outside, I'll be honest with you, I live in Nashville, and the Titans now are in real trouble. And it was one of those situations where when I hear people here locally talk about the Titans' chances now at 0-2, it's now better win the division because here's Miami and here's all these other teams. But Miami is on the forefront of yet another AFC team that could be in the way of getting one of the wild card spots if they don't win the division.
Correct. And then you got a few teams in that boat, too. You got not only the Titans, you got the Raiders, you got the Bengals. It's interesting. And if you're going to mention the Titans, I have no choice but to say, basically, you guys are discovering what we found out over the course of seven seasons. That Ryan Tannehill is a fine quarterback if he's got a great running game going around him where he can do the play action passing. Otherwise,
Oh, Alan, if I had a nickel for every Ryan Tannehill now today, oh my goodness. One final question, though. In the end, the things that were expected to work for the Dolphins in terms of defensively, is that two games? Are we seeing what they are? Does that what happened against Baltimore early open it up to some problems?
Yeah, no, I think there's reason for concern, especially when you're coming up against a Buffalo team that obviously can move the ball. Because Lamar Jackson sliced them and diced them pretty well there for, let's say, the first three quarters. And now, on top of the issues they already had, they have Xavien Howard, who missed practice on Wednesday because of a groin injury. They're already without Byron Jones, who has to miss at least the first four games because he's on pup. So, yeah, the defense right now is not at the level it needs to be, but the offense is above and beyond expectations. I think we had high hopes for what the offense could be with Mike McDaniel, with Tyreek Hill, with Raheem Mostert, and then another new guy. And it's far exceeded expectations. And if the defense can level up its play to where it was most of last year, and the possibilities are very interesting.
This team is so fun, and it's just such an interesting thing that is occurring down there. Really appreciate your time, my friend. Thank you so much.
You got it. Anytime, partner.
You got it, man. Alan Poppar on the Dolphins. 2-0, and man, four touchdowns, five touchdowns in the second half, six touchdowns overall for Tua Tagovailoa. And by the way, he's the AFC Offensive Player of the Week. We'll come back, wrap up the wake-up call as we continue.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Family ties on this day. My God, you keep surprising me with these themes on the Throwback Thursday.
And that's why I put it down. I said you'd be surprised at how many shows debuted on this date. I was just going through this list like, Mike, look, it's hit after hit after hit.
My goodness. Okay, this show, this is like an 80s show.
Yeah, debuted in 82.
Like, no, I mean, like if you ran it today, you could go, that's an 80s show. That's from the 80s. That's Reagan. That's Reaganomics. He's a conservative kid with liberal parents. And it was a typical family comedy, mom and dad and the crazy kids and whatnot. And Michael J. Fox was becoming a mega star. Whatever happened to Justine Bateman? Did she ever do anything with her life, or did she?
I think she went behind the camera and then just.
Oh, did she really?
I
wow,
think so.
Good for her.
And then just lives off her brother.
Yeah, brother. Yeah, her brother's probably paying all the bills for everything, right? But but this was part of the Thursday lineup.
Yep.
On NBC, so, and Michael J. Fox again merging as a star. Family Ties. It was. I liked the show. I thought it was a good show.
I did too.
I remember watching. I was a high school kid watching. I thought it was good. They had that one episode, though. They always get serious. Like, this show had a lot of serious episodes, and it always made me kind of like, it's a comedy. Can we stop? But there was one where, like, Alex was supposed to get in a car and his friend died. He said no, and he didn't get in a car, and his friend died in a car accident, and he was kind of going through this trauma. And they had this, like, special show where he was going to a psychiatrist, and he was acting out different scenes of his life. And it was, like, this poignant acting moment for Michael J. Fox, where it was, like, all centered on him. He was the episode.
Kind of like a player just needing more film.
Right. Yeah.
You know, football player, like, who's playing, you know, playing somewhere else. He's like, I'm doing, I need film.
The whole thing was to highlight Michael J. Fox, this rising star, and they put him in different emotional, dramatic scenes where he could really get his range out there. But, you know, that was the thing about 80s TV was, and MASH was the one that sort of broke this. Like, you didn't ever see you never saw a very special I Dream of Jeannie or a very special Gilligan's Island, right? And then MASH came along, and MASH mixed war and comedy, but sometimes you had to do the war. Like, sometimes you had to focus on the war. And so you'd have these serious moments. And by the time the 80s rolled around with comedies, they were always willing to go, yep, this is a funny show, but we're going to do a Don't Do Drugs episode. Or we're going to do a... Yep. Pedophile episode with Dudley and Arnold on Different Strokes. Or we're going to do a million different serious topics.
Drunk driving episode with Punky Brewster.
Drunk driving episode. Don't hide in the refrigerator of your parents' basement. Whatever it was that was dangerous, they did a special episode.